is Abby. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Abby.
Hi. My sobriety date is October 19th of 2007, and my home group is the Happy Destiny group in Chatham. So thanks for having me again. I guess it wasn't terrible, so you had me back for a second week, so thanks. So I think I guess I'm going to cover steps 4 through 9 tonight, which is a lot. It's a lot of stuff. When I did the workshops in Berkeley Heights, the big book workshops, we would devote 2 weeks just to step 4. So it's a lot of material, but I'll try to be brief and concise and to the point. So to sum up about steps 1, 2, 3, it's basically just saying that you're done and you surrender and you're willing to try a new way. That's it. I mean, it's a lot of words, a lot of stuff in the big book, a lot of, you know, whatever, but that's kind of the essence of the steps. And my experience working with other people is that unless you're done and willing to surrender and willing to try a new way, it doesn't really work, you know. A doesn't really work, the program of recovery doesn't really work, and then, I don't know, that's just what it is. So is there anyone here who's never done a 4-step before? Cool. Oh, yeah, he's like, yeah, kind of, I don't know. So I always, like, if I do something like this, I like to just explain what it is, what we're talking about, because this is the first time that you kind of have, like, an assignment to do in the book. And I don't know if, like, clear-cut directions is the right way to explain it, because, like, it's a little confusing, you know what I mean? And that's, like, you have a sponsor to take you through it and to explain it to you. Like, if I'd never taken statistics before, someone would just hand me a statistics textbook. That was a terrible example. I can't even say that word. But they wouldn't just hand me a textbook and say, learn it, you know? And that's the same thing with the material. Like, it's a little weird, and it's hard to understand if someone's not actively explaining it to you and giving you directions and giving you the assignments with what the text says. So don't listen to me right now and then go home and try to write a 4-step because you probably won't be able to do it. So basically what it is a list of 3 different, we call them inventories, where you sort of review the things that have happened in your life in a more constructive way than possibly you've done it before. I know for me when I was drinking, I was the perpetual victim, right? So like everyone was to blame for all of my problems all of the time. If it was like school or work or my parents or my friends or whatever, like, you know, I blamed on the bad influences in my life when, you know, in fact, I was the bad influence, you know, like, so I really, you know, my perspective of the world was that, like, everyone had done me wrong, you know, which is cool. I mean, you could live like that, but it's not very productive, especially if you want to get well and get sober. So what we do here is through these series of 3 inventories, which are like written charts, essentially, we go and we look through our history and we look through our lives in a different way, you know, and basically what happens is there's transformation and a new perspective, and we look at it where we're not the victim anymore, you know, we can own our own mistakes, and we can own our own conduct, and it's important, you know. I'm not one for dwelling in the past. I can, you know, definitely fall into that trap. But the things that have happened to us and the things that, you know, our experiences do shape the way that we think about the world, you know. And we can't change the past. I can't erase the things that I did or the things that happened to me. I can't do it. I don't have a time machine. It's just not going to happen. I'm not getting my hopes up for one. I can absolutely change my perspective so that I can move forward, you know, instead of being stuck in the past and stuck thinking about this stuff over and over and over. So the first little inventory, we call it, this little chart that we make, there actually is a fun chart in the big book to follow, an example. I have my first edition with me. I think it's page 65 in I just forgot my big book, and this is just the one I keep in the car as a backup. But if you go to... 65, sorry, yeah. So we talk about... So this first one that you're going to make, this first chart, is talking about in the first column, it's going to be 4 columns, and the first one is going to be the people that you're resentful at, you know. And I was like, cool, that's awesome, you know. I've done that a lot. I've made a first column in my head and verbally to lots of people over and over again and complained about the people in my life. The second column, so you make the second chart, second column in the chart, is a cause. Like, why am I pissed off? It's not that hard either. Like, we all know why we're upset with people. You know, when I talk to people, like, there's always, like, five names that come up automatically. You know what I mean? And then you do a little digging, and then there's, like, five more, and then five more. And, you know, sometimes people have, like, 500, which is crazy. But, you know, like, it's rare that I come across people who are, like, I have no resentments, which some people do feel that way. And they're usually wrong. So then we go to the third column, which is what part of self it affects. So up top, it says, was our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with. You know, so then you write in, how did that resentment affect you? You know, were your feelings hurt? Were your self-esteem hurt? Did someone steal from you and it hurt your financial ambitions? You know, did someone cheat on you and it hurt your sex relations? You know, that kind of stuff. And then if I'm working with someone who's new in recovery and has never done a four step, I tell them to stop there. Just do the first three columns. Now, why do we do this? Super, super, super important. This book, I don't know if you were here last week, but I said it, like, this isn't about tips and tricks how to avoid drinking. Or this isn't like how to control your drinking. This isn't ways to avoid your triggers or anything like that, or avoiding people. This is about addressing the underlying causes and conditions of our alcoholism, the spiritual malady, you know, that deep soul sickness inside of us that makes us angry and depressed and hurt and anxious and just suicidal, homicidal, unable to function in a world, fearful, you know, the stuff inside of us that causes us to drink. So it says in the big book on page, it's going to be 64 probably, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all form of spiritual disease for which we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So it's really important. So, you know, I talked about before about how we have the phenomenon of craving. When we pick up a drink, we can't control how much we're going to take. When we put it down, we have the mental obsession, so we can't control when we're going to pick up again, because our brain's always going to tell us it's a really super-duper idea to pick up a drink, you know? And so we're not saying, okay, here are ways to get better and stop thinking about drinking and stop having that phenomenon of craving or anything like that. We're saying, let's cure the underlying causes and conditions, you know, or at least recover from them. And so we don't even think about it. So the drink problem's removed, you know? I don't know if that makes sense, especially if you're new in recovery, but it will if you experience it. I'll give you a couple examples from, you know, the Abby Finch history of four steps. So one of my favorites was my sister. And that is a resentment that's, you know, very difficult for me to get over even now, just because she's a very difficult person to deal with. So something that happened, she used to steal from me all the time. You know, she would steal my clothes, my money, my drugs. She would steal from me all the time. And it affected, you know, my security, you know, my financial and emotional security. I didn't like people being in my things and taking my stuff without permission. It's invasive. You know, my personal relationships, because we would scream and yell at each other, and I'm like, can't have my stuff, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just, and I hated her so much. And then, so I wrote those three things out when I did my thing. And then we met, and this is kind of going to tie in together with the fifth step, right? So the fifth step is basically reading your four step, these three series of charts, to your sponsor. That's it. So in the fifth step, that's when we got to the fourth column that I left blank. And again, if I'm working with someone who's done this before, I'm just like, write out your own fourth column and we'll go over it, because they kind of have a better idea of what to do. But that's my experience doing it for the first time. So what we did is we went back and we tried to look at it through a different way. Okay, instead of looking at it like, what did she do? She stole from me repeatedly. Still does. But that's okay. And so we've put aside the wrongs that other people had done, right? We stopped thinking about it, because all of us have sat in bar stools and in parties and used everyone as our personal therapist and complained about all the people that we hated and what they'd done to us and how they wronged us. Now we're going to do something completely radical and think about my mistakes. And what we write out here in the fourth column is we looked at the list again from a new angle, and we're going to look for where we've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. So the biggest thing that came out of this particular resentment with my sister and stealing is I stole from her too, you know? So I was a hypocrite. I can't be mad at someone for doing the exact same thing. Now she might have done it more and more aggressively and more, you know, more often and whatever. But I'm still a hypocrite. I still did the exact same behaviors, and I was unwilling to own that part of it before. Because when you're in the disease and in the sickness, it's a lot easier to live in that second column. So there are a lot more, like, heavier things. That's sort of just, like, a lighter example of, like, my selfish, self-seeking behavior. Like, I just wanted to be the victim there, you know. I didn't want to own my own part. I was dishonest for stealing from her. You know, I was selfish because I had my own motives, whatever. You know, I hit all the big ones. But, so, you know, usually what goes on in people's four steps, family's first, always. We all hate our families. And then to varying degrees. And that's it. We, like, look at it a different way. Look at my parents. Like, I was mad at my mom for being emotionally unavailable. Well, like, that's just because I was mad. She wasn't the version of the mom I wanted her to be. You know? You can't blame someone for not being who you think that the delusional thought you made up in your own mind. This is the kind of mom I want. I'm going to be mad because you're not that mom. You know, that's just not the way the world works. You can't choose your moms. You know, I'm mad at my dad for being an alcoholic. And here's a huge thing. My father is, like, one of those people who's, like, it says in, like, the doctor's opinion, who seems, like, almost completely normal except for the effect that drinking has on them. He's one of those people. I never worried about my father not coming home at night. He read to me every night when I was a kid. You know, we rode bikes together. I don't know why I had a really hard time with that. Sorry, I was at the beach all day. My brain is fried. And my dad was, like, an amazing father, despite, like, the fact he was drunk all the time, you know? Like, pretty sure he did all those things drunk. And he still continues to this day. Like, shows up, you know, I have an 8-year-old daughter, like, participates and goes to her events, and sometimes he's a little wasted, you know? But, like, he shows up. He's an amazing father, despite his illness. You know, and I honestly, I don't know, had I kept drinking, if I could have been the same kind of parent. I don't know. And so that, and then, and there, these are huge changes in our thinking and huge change in our perspective. And it's not only a change in the way we're looking at our past, but in the way we look at our future as well. Because people will continue to piss us off. They will continue to harm us. They will continue to make me upset. You know. You know, like, And that's what we do in, like, the 10th step and 11th step and taking regular inventory with our sponsors and other people and with God. You know, you start looking at these everyday sort of resentments in a whole new way. You know, I've realized lately that I'm super paranoid. You know, like, my boyfriend doesn't text me back for 2 hours and I'm like, he's with another woman or he's drunk or, like, something, you know, like, something crazy, you know, that, like, none of the evidence has would lead me to believe he's doing anything nefarious. He's, like, probably busy. You know, maybe he's, like, watching TV, wants to concentrate on what he's watching. I don't know. But I'm, like, crazy and paranoid, and, like, I've been in this relationship about 7 months, and it's my first serious relationship in about 5 years. I got divorced when I was, like, 24. And I just came up all these insecurities I never knew I had, you know? And so that's a whole new set of, like, doing these kind of work to get through it. Like, what's really going on, you know? And so that kind of leads into this fear inventory we're talking about next. So that's our second little chart that we're going to make. We do a fourth step. I've seen it done a couple of different ways, but basically you're looking at what fears you have, you know, what you're doing to set them up, how you're contributing to them, And then looking at, like, what's a better way instead of living in fear. And let me tell you, like, I never doubted that I was a fearful person. I'm, like, terrified of everything. And some fears have kind of gotten over, you know, and new ones have cropped up. Because that's just how being a human being works. Like, we don't just, like, do the work and get cured and be, like, wonderful, fabulous people who don't have any problems anymore. So I'm trying to think of, like, what I had originally on my fears list. I can't even remember. I'll just do a recent fear then. Fear of, like, my whole life right now. I'm trying to put it into like, words I could describe. So basically, I just finished graduate school. I'm doing a big career change. I'm living with my parents for the first time in, like, 10 years, for the past year and a half. And I'm freelancing, and I am afraid I'm going to be broke and living in my parents' basement forever, and I'm not going to find the right job, and I'm never going to pay off my student loan debt, and, like, my whole world's going to collapse. Whew! It's a lot, right? So how am I contributing to the fear? As part of it is, like, giving into self-pity. You know, a lack of gratitude that I have for the wonderful things in my life. Like, really cool stuff that's happened. Lack of gratitude to my parents for letting me and my daughter live there, you know. Not taking into account the evidence of my past, which is that God has always taken care of me. Always. And the past is, like, I'm probably not supposed to say this, but, like, I've pretty much gotten everything I've wanted in sobriety, whether I've taken it by force and made it happen, or whether it was more God-given and more God's will or whatever. Like, the things that I've wanted to happen have pretty much manifested, you know, in my life. So if I just be patient and take into account the evidence of the past, like, there's really nothing to be worried about, you know? So a different way of dealing and handling with this fear is, you know, practicing gratitude, you know, continuing to take action. You know, I get a little depressed, you know, some days. I've kind of got a job offer. It's not, like, official yet, but I switched careers from, like, advertising to journalism, which I don't know if you know anything about it. Journalism doesn't pay a lot. It's got a really expensive master's degree in it. And the offer that looks like it's going to be, like, a $35,000 pay cut, you know. So I'm like, am I really that committed to this career path, you know? So constant prayer, constantly turning it over to God. Because my experience is that God gives me the right answers and gives me the right direction as long as I stay patient and willing and stop making decisions based on fear. I've made so many impulsive decisions based on fear, whether it be jobs, relationships, whatever it is. My biggest thing is to sit still. Whew. And it is hard because I want to do stuff about it, you know. But the truth is, I don't want to end up where I'm in a living situation which isn't comfortable just because I want to get out of my parents' house. I don't want to end up with a job that I hate just because I wanted a job, you know. And I know me. I'm like I need stuff to change right now, so I'm just going to do it right now. So I just have to wait and be patient. I'm like, everything's going to be fine. Everything actually already is fine, you know? So, like, someone I talk to in the program a lot always says that to me. She's like, can you just accept that you don't actually have any real problems right now and that you're just creating them? Okay, so the last chart is, and I think that, so we want to be free of anger and we want to be free of fear, right? To overcome drinking. And the last thing is we review our harms when it comes to sex conduct, relationships, and all that kind of stuff. I also tell people, like, even if you got, like, a big thing, like, say you did something real bad and you feel a lot of guilt and shame about it, and it's not related to a sexual relationship or romantic relationship, put it on this list It's not specifically in the big book, but the harms we do aren't just to, like, people we're romantically involved with. But this is a little bit different, you know, and it really depends on the person, but this is another set of these little columns, charts, and I don't think it's important to write down every person you've had sex with or every person you've kissed or whatever. What we're really looking for is a pattern of behavior, you know? And so what you're going to write down is people or situations or whatever. You know, I've sponsored girls that, like, a few that, you know, have prostituted and whatever. Like, you're not going to write down every John you've ever had or, like, anything like that. It's just the point is prostitution, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, where we're going to go from there. It's not the point of each and every person. Does that make sense? Or, like, yeah. And what you do there is we talk about what happened, what was the situation, and then you talk right where you were, if you aroused jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness, you know, what kind of actions did you take? You know, were you... sorry. Oh, where had you been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Who did you hurt? Where did you unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness, you know? And then the last column is kind of like that my mistakes, my part kind of column from the other two. You know, what's a better way? What's a different way? What can you have done instead? So, like, I had this whole... This was really complicated for me, you know? And it's changed a lot over time. So I had this idea when I got sober that, like, I had sex with people because I was drunk, right? Like, I did that just because I was drunk. Like, there was no other motive besides, like, intoxication, right? And I had never really had a serious boyfriend or anything like that. I was always really scared of guys and romantic situations and really scared of being vulnerable and just I was just not good at that at all. Now, by doing this work, I realized that, like, it wasn't just because I was drunk. Maybe that gave me the catalyst to be able to do some of the things. But really, I used people. You know, I used men to make me feel better about myself because I had no self-esteem, no sense of self-worth, I just needed to be validated by another person, you know, and whether that was like a quick romantic encounter that meant absolutely nothing and probably didn't remember anyway, you know, I needed that validation in that moment, you know, and that's sort of what this work helped me realize, that, like, it's not okay to use people. The Joe and Charlie talks sum it up really well. If you ever get a chance to listen to them, if you're having sex for reasons other than procreation or for pleasure, then you probably have some sort of selfish motive behind it. Like, if you're just doing it because you love your partner and you want to have a nice experience together, or you both are just, it's a casual encounter and you both are, like, aware of that, you know, it's going to be a one-night stand, not going to go anywhere, and those expectations are set up front, nothing wrong with that, you know what I mean? Just want to have fun, whatever. But if you're doing it because you're lonely. Mm. Are you doing it because, like, I don't know, the reasons guys have sex, because, like, you want to, like, feel masculine or whatever, I don't really know. I know for women it's more like needing to feel, like, validated by a man, you know, because we feel so awful about ourselves. And, you know, I really, like, when I work with newcomers, it just, I don't feel necessarily comfortable saying, like, here's a timeline of when you should be ready to date again, because I don't know, like, I don't know if that's the thing we can really determine. Mm-hmm. But I know that, like, we're so broken when we get here, you know, and we're so screwed up when it comes to romantic relationships. And 99% of the people that I have worked with have had some kind of sexual abuse, rape, assault, molestation as a child, and, you know, I urge them to get, you know, outside counsel for that, because, like, that screws you up real bad. It really does. You know, men, women, doesn't matter. And that was another thing that was big. I mean, the first time I did a fourth step, it was the first time I ever talked about being raped. You know, I'd never told anyone about that before. I didn't even think about telling anyone about it. Like, it wasn't even a thought, like, oh, I was just like, I'm just going to go along with my life and pretend that never happened, you know? But something compelled me. Like, I was like, I need to talk about this, you know, or I might go back and drink. You know, it was one of those, like, intuitive gut feelings that you have. And then I, like, 7 years sober, had a huge experience. I was started recovering from, this is jumping ahead, an eating disorder, and I, you know, had a lot of things going on, and I went through the steps again, and I had this whole experience of all this new purging come out, you know, and there was more assault in there, and there was more, you know, things that I'd never told anyone. It took me 7 years of sobriety to admit that I was in a car accident, which I injured other people. You know, I broke a 10-year-old girl's arm, and, you know, room got tense, and, you know, permanently injured, you know, her father as well. You know, it took me a really long time, and it wasn't even because I was purposely holding it back. I genuinely just don't think I was ready to talk about it, you know, because there was so much guilt, shame, and remorse. So, like, your first 4-step, you're just going to do the best you can and be as honest as you can. Am I, you know, this is just a belief. If you leave stuff out purposefully, and then you don't admit it afterwards, you're probably not done drinking. You know? That's been my experience working with other people. So, that's a lot. And that was kind of... So the 4-step and the 5th step are intertwined. Basically, you're reading your 4-step to your sponsor after you finish writing it. I usually give people, like, 2 or 3 weeks to write it. You know? I'm like, doesn't have to be a novel. You're not writing the Moby Dick of sobriety. You know? Like, this is just... want bullet points about what happened, you know, and really the experience that I have with women doing a 5th step is so much more powerful than just writing it out. When you really get to talk about it and really get to admit it and really get to what's really happening, you know, and pointing out their part in a loving, gentle manner. You know, it's a beautiful experience. It really, really is. And I've done several 4-steps. Some people only do it once. I've done it a few. Because, like I've said, I've been in different places in my life. You know, when I was 19, I viewed the world very differently than at 29, which I am now, you know. A lot has happened since then, in the almost 10 years I've been sober. And then there was a couple years when I didn't really do AA very much, and I wasn't really into it, and I did a lot of really screwed up things, and, you know, had to do a lot of work there, too. So I had this idea when I got sober, I was going to do these 4 steps, I was going to realize my character defects and how all this stuff was destroying me inside, and I was just going to be good. Like, I was just going to be a good person from here on out. Yeah, it's a lot harder than that. It's not simple. You know, recovery isn't linear at all. You know, sometimes I'm taking 2 steps forward, 1 step back in my behavior. I recovered very slowly, I think. I got over thinking about drinking relatively quickly, but my behavior took a really long time to change. That's probably not what you want to hear, but... It's the truth. I mean, my first, you know, I mean, going into a little bit with 6 and 7, where we just kind of get willing to have God remove our character defects and just realize that we're not in control of our the way we think or act, really, like God is. Yeah, I had a hard time. Like, I was really nuts. For a long time, I was really insecure. I got in a relationship way too young and way too soon. And was jealous and crazy and, you know, acted out on all of those character defects, you know. And my experience now is that it's not that I don't have those things from the 4th column anymore. It's not that I don't get resentful or selfish or jealous or whatever. I don't really act on them the way I used to, if that makes any sense. So, like, right now, like, I'm feeling like boyfriend's being weird and distant, and I just want to, like, call him and be like, what is wrong with you, you know? But I'm like, I'm just giving him space. I don't know. Like, instead of being accusatory and, like, who are you with, you know? Like, that's crazy. Just let it go. whatever. I am entitled to be paranoid. Like, I can take steps to get out of it, but I don't have to harm people or cause an argument because of the way I'm feeling. I thought sobriety was like, I'm going to feel good all the time. I don't. Whatever, it's life. I don't feel good all the time. I feel good well, most of the time, I guess. You know, I don't know. It comes and goes. But, you know, I don't have to, like, constantly live in, like, harming people, feeling guilty, apologizing, that circle of just insanity. So I guess I'll just go and read The Fist That Promises. So this is what's supposed to happen after we do a fist step. This is after you read it to your sponsor and you kind of go through and where you were at fault and your fears and dissect your behaviors and whatever. So we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had spiritual beliefs, but now we have begun a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hands in hand with the spirits of the universe. So my experience with this is it doesn't come right away. The few fifth steps that I've done, my own, I felt like a jerk afterwards. I was like, wow, I really messed up a lot. There was some where I felt like physically ill afterwards, you know, just really getting down to the causes and conditions. My experience is that stuff came, but it just came in time with continued work and continued action. You know, it didn't have to just all of a sudden I felt the spirit of God and, you know, my whole body lit up and it was just wonderful, beautiful experience. Like, you know, the drink problem started to slip away without me really realizing it. I do remember feeling more able to be like less embarrassed to talk to people, I guess. Like, I don't know, I was really, really shy when I was new, and I felt like I opened up a little bit more to people and was like a little less socially awkward. Still working on that, but yeah, but definitely, like, I think that spiritual experience starts to come around here, and it's pretty powerful. So to quickly just review 6 and 7 before I go to 8 and 9. These are quick, right? Two paragraphs. So here we talk about A is 6 is being willing to let God mold us into like good people. And then 7 is saying, okay, God, I'm ready. And my general attitude is that I've waxed and waned on this willingness to let God completely take over and have all of me. Some days I take my will back and I just want to figure it out, and sometimes I know when I'm being self-will run riot, if that makes sense. I'm like, I know this shouldn't do this. Or I'm like, I know I'm just going to go frivolously go shopping because I feel like shit right now. Like, I know it, you know? However, this is sort of like the thing that, like, we are powerless over not only alcohol or drugs or whatever your thing is, you know, we're powerless over the parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily like or that aren't necessarily working for us. I can't just wake up tomorrow and say, I want to be a different person. I want to be better, because we all said it, right? Tomorrow it's going to be different. Tomorrow's gonna be different. Tomorrow was never different. Tomorrow was always the same as the other days. It was miserable. And I do that now. We don't do it. Tomorrow I'm gonna start a new diet. Tomorrow I'm not gonna, like, you know, overspend. Tomorrow I'm not gonna gossip. tomorrow I'm not going to, like, be bratty to my parents. And then tomorrow comes and I do all of those things. Unless I'm willing to say, hey, God, do whatever you want with my brattiness and my gossiping and my finances. Do whatever you want with it. Take it away right now. You know, let me mess up some more. And, you know, let me not care about the results. Because when I hold on to the parts of me that I don't like, or the parts of me I do like, the fear is that if I change, if I do something different, I won't like the outcome. So this is just another form of surrender. I don't know if I explained that well at all, but I hope, well, hopefully, yeah, I got something out of it. I'm just kind of in a rush to get to steps 8 and 9. But yeah, so sometimes I'm more willing, and sometimes I get pretty specific. You know, if I'm having a problem overspending, I say, God, take... I don't say, help me stop overspending. God, take control of my finances. And then I don't know what's going to happen. right? Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But that's what it's saying. I'm willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. In moments where I'm feeling paranoid about my relationship or insecure, I say, God, take my relationship. Not, God, let me be less insecure and paranoid and weird for no reason. Because maybe I'm right. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe there's some crazy conspiracy against me. Just, God, take my relationship. God, take my living situation. You know? Take my relationship with my parents. And usually things get better. They really do. Like, when I was almost filed for bankruptcy last year, I just asked God to, like, take control of my finances. And what he did was led me to, like, a financial planner who helped me work through things. You know? It's not like I had to figure everything out on my own. Okay. Let's do all that. Now, here's, like, my least favorite part of the whole 12 steps. And probably the best part at the same time, if that makes any sense. It's usually the stuff that we don't want to do the most, in general, in life, that is always the most rewarding. Right? You know? And it's the amends. Woof! So, basically, what step 8 asks you to do is to make a list of the people that you've harmed, and you take them from your 4-step. You know, you take those people, and then you write out the stuff that you came across in the 4th column. People from your sex inventory, if any people came up from your fear inventory. And then I say, like, sometimes there's no people that you were resentful at, but you still know you harmed them. For me, that was a teacher that I had when I was my senior year of high school. I had this English teacher, and I had her for all 4 years, and we were really close. You know, even though I was like, you know, whatever. Anyway, she was very, I don't know, she was amazing. But she saw the progression in me. Like, when I started high school, I was like, you know, honors English, like, star writer, you know, that kind of thing. That's my thing. And by the end, I, like, could barely show up to class. I reeked of cigarettes and drugs and booze all the time. Like, I was disgusting, you know. And she really went out of her way and was just like, I remember her sitting me down after class, and she was just like, had tears in her eyes. She was like, what happened to you? You know? And I ended up, she just did all this stuff for me, and I ended up cheating on my English final in her class. That's how I repaid her. Yeah, and it doesn't seem like the worst things that you could do as an alcoholic, but it was messed up. You know, we had a special relationship, and she was so hurt by it. So hurt. I didn't have a resentment against her, but, like, I knew I had to make an amends to her. And skipping ahead, like, to this day, she's the only person that's never seen me for an amends. She's the only person who's refused. And I heard from a person probably about 5 or 6 years ago who had run into her and brought my name up, this girl that I went to high school with. She brought my name up, and she said, she went off, the teacher went off on a tangent about me and said that she had never since then gone out of her way to help any other student ever again. You know? So, I always say in the amends process, that's when we really learn the truth. It's the fifth step is pretty much my version of the truth and probably a little bit closer. But I don't really know how I actually harmed people until you hear their side of things. So I heard her side of things. She wouldn't let me, you know, talk to her face to face. But my action, which seems kind of innocuous, like in the grand scheme of things, cheating on a test, caused this woman to change her entire teaching career and the way she taught and the way she helped people, you know, and the way she interacted with students. So we have no idea what we do. And basically, you know, and it says it in the third step, all of my actions just come out of this intense selfishness, you know. Alcoholics are so weirdly selfish, you know, like, and it's all about getting what I want, when I want it, and how I want it, and not caring about how that affects other people. And so what doing an amends list is, you know, start doing the list, you make you write out what you did, you know, do it however you want. I know people like to do it in columns or write it on index cards. Like, I don't, like, format to me is irrelevant as long as you're getting down the basic what it is, you know. And then the ninth step is actually going out and making your amends with people. And it's not doing what we've done a million times and saying, sorry, I promise I'll never do it again. I'll never do it again. I swear to God, I'll never do it again, and then I'm just going to do it again tomorrow. What an amends is a restitution of harms. It's trying to make right what we did in the past. It's going to people, and usually seeing them one-on-one, face-to-face, and saying, this is what I did to harm you, and I'm acknowledging it. Because half the time, people just want you to acknowledge it, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. It's maddening when you go around life saying sorry and you don't even acknowledge what you did wrong or really even care. It's maddening to other people, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I know from being on the other side of it. It makes people crazy. So it's acknowledging, it's detailing. This is exactly what I did to harm you. You know, for my parents, it was a lot of, like, I didn't do a whole lot of stealing, but it was starting lots of fights for no reason. It was shutting them out of my life. It was doing lots of impulsive things without any regard, breaking the rules, staying out late and not telling them where I was, robbing them of their sanity, and just completely acting out of selfishness and with disregard and a lack of any sort of gratitude for the fact that they were pretty decent parents. My parents took it pretty well. They were good. Most of my original amends were pretty benign. There was a lot of, like, just keep doing what you're doing. So proud of you. And it was good. I mean, I went to an old boss, and, you know, I worked in the purchasing department of my old college, and I would just filed things. I would go in the basement, and I would just drink vodka and, like, take, like, 3 hours to file, like, two things, you know what I mean? Like, and I guess everyone else was have been so terrible that I was, like, the star employee. Oh, I also told them that my grandmother had died and I needed to take a week off, which was a lie. My grandmother's had died years prior. I killed them again in order. And then I took a week off and then never showed up again to work, ever. So that was immense. But I don't know if everyone else was just so terrible at this job. They were like, you know, Barb hasn't trusted anyone with the filing since you left. I was like, really? I was like, maybe you need to stop hiring students to do your work. But so most of them were pretty cool. A lot of people had a lot of questions, which I was, like, a little uncomfortable with when you're new in sobriety, you know, like, what is this all about, and all that. There was a lot of friends. In high school, I was either really shy and nervous and awkward, or I was so mean to people, like, just unnecessarily mean. If I had any sort of, felt that I had any sort of, like, if I was superior to you at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I would just be ruthless. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my nuns to people in high school were just, you know, sorry for being such a bitch, you know, and just purposely leaving people out of things and purposely, like, name-calling and gossiping. And then there's the things that you don't really, like, that making amends to do would cause more harm, you know, and some of those things are things that people don't know about, you know, if, I don't need to tell everyone everything just to absolve my own conscience. The amends is I have to live with it and not do it again. You know, I did some really screwed up things. A friend of mine, like, accused this guy of rape, and behind her back, unbeknownst to her, I, like, was just tore her apart. You know, I called her a slut, and... You know, and I don't know what happened, really, to be honest. Who knows? I wasn't there. But I told everyone behind her back that she was lying. And I don't even know why I did this. Like, for attention? I don't know. But that's not like something I'm going to go tell her. You know, I told everyone that you lied about being raped. Like, that's crazy. You're not going to tell somebody that. The fact is, I have to live with it. You know, that I was just cruel to people. So, I kind of alluded to this before. I went through this kind of self-will run riot phase in sobriety from about 2013 to 2015 or 16-ish. I got divorced. I got married really young. I got divorced really young. You know, I got really sick of AA after a little while. It wasn't so much resentment. It was probably more judgment, I think. You know, especially when you think that everyone in AA is, like, pure and, like, good, and then you realize that, like, people make all sorts of mistakes and do all sorts of... You know, I really, like, soured my view of some people, which is why I try to be as honest as possible. Like I'm not, like, an angel at all. So I kind of distanced myself from AA, and I... First... Like, it was like drinking. At first, it was really fun. Like, I went out to lots of bars and clubs, and I did all the things that, like, 25 and 26, 24-year-olds are supposed to do. You know, I had a baby really young. I got married really young. I got sober really young. And I was like, screw all that. Like, I'm going out. I suddenly, all of my friends were no longer in the rooms. They were, like, outside of the rooms, which was fine, but they weren't all the most well people. You know, when you take advice from people that aren't necessarily well, you're not really going to take the right action. Mm-hmm. And I started spiraling out of control. I developed a crazy shopping addiction. I was addicted to online shopping. Like, I racked up thousands and thousands of dollars in credit card debt. I had trouble with eating disorders prior, but it kind of restarted again, and I was just, like, engaged in a lot of, like, really crazy behaviors from that. Which, you know, this is AA, so I won't really get into it, but it was just, like, a hot mess. My sex conduct, out of control. Like, I just did, like, talk about selfish motives up the wazoo, you know, like, use people, harm people, like, just did the most screwed up things. What else? Oh, I would steal from my company that I was working for at the time. I was a consultant, and I overbilled them, like, repeatedly, hours that I didn't work. It was just a lot of stuff that, like, listen, my sponsor says you could do whatever you want in sobriety as long as you're willing to pick up the tab. My tab wasn't drinking over any of this stuff. My tab was, like, serious emotional pain. I'm telling you, like... suicidal, insomnia, like, just, I could not live with myself. I was disgusted with myself. And I couldn't blame it on drinking or drugging. This is just kind of who I am without a spiritual solution. Without God, without helping others in the 12 steps, I am a reckless human being. And I had a lot of stuff going on that I was not dealing with well at all. You know, I got really sick. Physically, I almost lost my job. I had the divorce going on, and I lost a couple friends due to addiction. So, I use those as fun excuses for my terrible, terrible behavior. Cut to about 2 years ago, I have another bottom. Just, like, the insomnia was killing me. I was literally calling suicide hotlines. I thought I was going to kill myself. Like, it was just so bad. I don't know how I didn't pick up a drink. And I went through the steps again, and I did another fourth and fifth step. And that's when those other things that I was talking about came up, you know, with the assault and the injuring people and whatever. But then a whole new set of amends also came up. Mm-hmm. And these were horrible amends to make. But I was so desperate. So desperate. I was like, I had a lot to lose, you know. I had a career, and I had been to college, and I had a daughter, and I owned, like, I am, you know, a car. I paid for my own house and all this stuff, you know what I mean? I had a lot of stuff to lose. It wasn't like getting sober at 19 when I had nothing. You know, my parents supported me, and it was like, whatever. You know, like, there was a lot on the line. And I was so desperate to just do anything. And I just made these, oh, my God. My sister, that was fun. She basically told me that I treated her less than human. She just told her, like, it just went on and on about how awful I was to her. My ex-husband, that was fun, too. I had a lot of expectations. Like, we get along really well now. We have a good relationship. And that's how it was, you know, a couple years ago. But and so I was like, oh, he's just going to say, like, keep doing what you're doing, and you're great. And nope. Like, just, like, it's like he had been waiting for this opportunity to just, like, just go into me and, like, detailed everything I had ever done to upset him. And I kind of expected him to make amends, too. He's, like, sober, too. But that's so not what happened. And it was awful, you know? I mean, I was 5 years sober. I keyed this man's car, you know? Like, it was just, it was awful. And, like, that was, like, the tip of the iceberg, you know? But I needed to hear the truth. You know, I really needed to hear how my actions were affecting other people. It sucks. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. But the freedom that you get is incredible. You know? Nothing in my life has been worthwhile that I haven't worked really hard for. And this is one of them. Like I said, I don't like doing amends, and I still do them, you know. Pretty formal amends a couple months ago. I don't know, maybe back in January, I had another similar experience where, like, I had been dating this guy last year, and I ended things super abruptly without, like, any indication. He just kind of was like, what happened? And so I made an amends because of that, and I kind of explained, you know, what had happened, and he did the same thing. He just went into me and was, like, detailed all this stuff, and I just had to sit back and say, okay, I'm sorry. What can I do to make it right? And that's, like, the final part of the amends is just asking people, did I leave anything out? Apparently I've left things out. So I've learned. What can I do to make it right? I really, like, people are just like, stop doing that. Like, stop doing that, you know? Think about other people. Act better. Sorry, I'm going over a little bit, but the last 2 years have basically been, like, getting sober again for me. And it's been a really incredible journey, and I like to think that I'm experiencing the most, even though I still kind of have, like, some pretty big waves of self-pity and depression and stuff, I'm experiencing the most sober I've ever been sober, as far as, like, not acting on any of my feelings, and not harming people, and I'm super proud of myself. So, I mean, like, there is an incredible freedom in all this work. You know, there is this shedding of, like, feeling the shame, guilt, and remorse. You know, I shared a lot with you guys in the last hour. I don't know any of you, maybe Cassie and Kevin, David over here. Like, I know a couple of you guys, but most of you don't. You know, I'm not really ashamed of the things that I shared about you. Like, they're just, the things that happened are just things that happened. They don't have to make me who I am today. And so that's the sort of freedom that we work towards here, where I can just walk around like a free woman and not have to hide my head in the sand or run from anyone in the grocery store or, like, pretend that I'm someone that I'm not. You know, because this is just who I am. And with God's help, I can continue to be a better person. So that's all I have to share. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.